Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasad Buddhale Shimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasota Devi Gauravani Prachalane Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pashachadeshu Tadane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare Priya Mishma Bhav Canto 3 Chapter 29 Verse 15. Nisevatena nimittena svadharmena mahiyasa kriya yogena sastena nati himsrena nityasaha nisevatena nimittena svadharmena mahiyasa kriya yogena sastena nati himsrena nichasaha nisevatena executed animitena without attachment to the result svadharmena by one's prescribed duties. Mahiyasa. Glorious. Kriya Yogena. By devotional activities. Sastena. Auspicious. None. Without. Atihim Sena. Excessive violence. Nityasaha, regularly. Translation, a devotee must execute his prescribed duties, which are glorious, without material profit, without excessive violence. One should regularly perform one's devotional activities. One has to execute his prescribed duties according to his social position as a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, or Sudra. The prescribed duties of the four classes of men in human society are also described in Bhagavad Gita. The activities of Brahmanas are to control the senses and become simple, clean, learned devotees. Kshatriyas have a spirit for ruling. They are not afraid of the battlefield and they are charitable. The Vaishyas, or the mercantile class of men, trade in commodities, protect cows, and develop agricultural produce. The Sudras, or labor class, serve the higher classes because they themselves are not very intelligent. From every position, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Sva Karmana Tam Abhyarcha, one can serve the Supreme Lord by performing one's prescribed duty. It is not that only the Brahmanas can serve the Supreme Lord and not the Sudras. Anyone can serve the Supreme Lord by performing his prescribed duties under the direction of a spiritual master or representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No one should think that his prescribed duties are inferior. A Brahmana can serve the Lord by using his intelligence. The Kshatriya can serve the Supreme Lord by using his military arts, just as Arjuna served Krishna. Arjuna was a warrior. He had no time to study Vedanta or other highly intellectual books. The damsels of Rajabhumi were girls born in the Vaishya class, and they engaged in protecting cows and producing agriculture. Krishna's foster father, Nanda Maharaj, and his associates were all Vaishyas. They were not at all educated, but they could serve Krishna by loving him and by offering everything to him. Similarly, there are many instances in which Chandalas, or those lower than Sudras, have served Krishna. Also, the sage Vidura was considered a Sudra because his mother happened to be a Sudra. There are no distinctions, for it is declared by the Lord in Bhagavad Gita that anyone engaged specifically in devotional service is elevated to the transcendental position without a doubt. Everyone's prescribed duty is glorious if it is performed in devotional service of the Lord without desire for profit. Such loving service must be performed without reason, without impediment, and spontaneously. Krishna is lovable, and one has to serve him in whatever capacity one can. That is pure devotional service. Another significant phrase in the verse is na ati himsrena, without, with minimum violence or sacrifice of life. Even if a devotee has to commit violence, it should be not done beyond what is necessary. Sometimes the question is put before us, you ask us not to eat meat, but you're eating vegetables. Do you think that that is not violence? The answer is that eating vegetables is violence. And vegetarians are also committing violence against other living entities because vegetables also have life. Non-devotees are killing cows, goats, and so many other animals for eating purposes. And a devotee who's vegetarian is also killing. But here, significantly, it is stated that every living being has to live by killing another entity. That is the law of nature. Jivo jivasya jivanam. One living entity is a life for another living entity. But for a human being, that violence should be committed only as much as necessary. A human being is not to eat anything which is not offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yagya shishtashna shanta. One becomes freed from all sinful reactions by eating foodstuffs which are offered to yagya, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A devotee therefore eats only prasad or foodstuffs offered to the Supreme Lord. And Krishna says that when a devotee offers him foodstuffs from the vegetable kingdom with devotion, he eats that. A devotee is to offer to Krishna foodstuffs prepared from vegetables. If the Supreme Lord wanted foodstuffs prepared from animal food, the devotee could offer this, but he does not order to do that. We have to commit violence. That is a natural law. We should not, however, commit violence extravagantly, but only as much as ordered by the Lord. Arjuna engaged in the art of killing, and although the killing is, of course, violence, he killed the enemy simply on Krishna's order. In the same way, if we commit violence as it is necessary by the order of the Lord, that is called na'ati himsa. We cannot avoid violence, for we are put into a conditional life in which we have to commit violence, but we should not commit more violence than necessary or than ordered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation, a devotee must execute his prescribed duties, which are glorious, without material profit. Without excessive violence, one should regularly perform one's devotional activities. So this is a chapter on devotional service spoken by Kapila Dev. And in this chapter, actually presents, among other things, pure devotional service. And he's previously mentioned how the devotee rejects even spiritual things, such as going to the planet of the Lord, getting a spiritual body, getting powers like the Lord, etc. So that's the highest type of devotional activity. And our acharyas mention how these activities are a particular type. Their very nature is devotional. That is, their intention from the very beginning is devotional. The goal is devotional. And we have different activities of engagement. That is engaging the senses. So on nectar devotion, Jiva Goswami gives the definition of pure bhakti as being anya abhilashita shunya, without any other desire than the desire to serve the Lord. And what is it? It is Krishna anusilanam, cultivating a relationship with the Lord favorably, anukulya. And then he goes on to define sadhana bhakti. And there he says it is kriti sadhya. Kriti means senses. So it is attaining the object, the goal, by using the senses. So we use our senses, which look material, and in most cases are material, in the service of the Lord without any other desire than to please the Lord. That is how we define sadhana bhakti. And then Rupa Goswami gives examples of how we engage the senses. So we engage a voice in kirtan, or in singing songs about the Lord, etc., talking about the Lord. We engage the ear in hearing about the Lord. We engage the eye in seeing the forms of the Lord, or seeing the forms of the devotees. We engage the hands and the feet in various activities, including archana, worshipping the Lord, offering things to the Lord. So in this way we can engage all of our senses, our action senses, and knowledge gathering senses in the service of the Lord. So these are called the direct devotional service. There are other activities which are not directly devotional service, such as people working at their job. So that's not mentioned among the 64 angas of bhakti, working in a computer shop or fixing a car or working as a laborer, digging roads for the government or something. These are not considered directly parts of bhakti. Nevertheless, people have to maintain their bodies and they get some money so they can survive. They have to raise their families. So this is not mentioned, these are not mentioned among the 64 angas of bhakti. But what do we do with these activities then? In different countries, of course, they have different activities. And in the Vedic system, all the activities were regulated. So this is what we call dharma. All these activities to support your body were regulated by certain rules and regulations. This is what we call dharma, or varnashram system. So not only the activities were regulated, they're regulated according to gunas. So if you're in tamagun, you're labeled a sudra, and then you have certain activities you do in that. Your occupation is there, and the occupation is limited by certain rules. Similarly with the kshatriya or the brahmana, etc. You have limitations of rules upon your activities in the gunas. Those are activities to support your body. So a lot of the varnashram activities are for artha, getting material things so you can support your body, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, basically. That's artha. And kama, get a little extra enjoyment for your recreation or whatever. So a lot of the system is for that, artha and kama. So of course the dharma restricts it in a certain way. Most countries have rules like that. They restrict people. You can't steal, you can't lie, you can't cheat. And they have rules for that. And you do too much, then they throw you in jail. So that's obviously there for keeping order in society, etc. So those are practical reasons for dharma. But the varnashram system has another reason for these rules, and that is to raise the consciousness through the gunas. That is not there in other systems in the world. So the idea is to gradually raise the consciousness of a jiva from tamogun to sattvagun. And when you come to sattvagun, the positive aspect is that you can begin to understand you're not the material body. This is what we call atma-jnana. So it's the beginning of spiritual life. So if you come to sattva, then you're more likely to take to spiritual life. And so as if sattva has this natural quality of atma-jnana, so naturally begin to think, I'm not the body, why do I have to spend so much time doing all these activities in the material world to support my body and my family? There must be some other goal in life. So that is coming from sattva influence. So if anybody, of course all people have sattva to some degree, even a sudra has a little sattva, so sometimes he may think like that also. But not so much. He's in sattva-guna, Brahman, then he will think like that much more. And then he will also pursue that maybe as a career, as a brahmana. So he begins to study the shastras for that purpose. So that's the varnashram system or dharma. And if you are doing your particular rule, following particular rules and regulations according to your varna, is called swadharma, as we see in this verse. Swadharma. You should do your swadharma to support your body and your family, etc. So, those rules are there to raise you up. And within the rules themselves, there's also rules for worship. But we have two types of worship. We have worship of devatas, and we have worship of the Supreme Lord. And both are recommended. But, of course, we cannot reject the worship of the Supreme Lord also. Otherwise, the system doesn't work. So, but within this system, we do have some bhakti in the form of worship of the Supreme Lord. But it is among other things, other types of worship and other activities. So therefore, we don't say that this whole system of varnashram dharma is bhakti itself, like hearing and chanting and whatever. So it's slightly different. And the goal also is slightly different. For most people, the goal is the artha and the kama. They're following the system so that they can get material benefits. So they're not following the system simply to surrender to the Lord. So the difference between the devotional activities and the svadharma activities is that the devotional activities are simply about surrendering completely to the Supreme Lord. It's the only goal. The sarup, or the very nature of the activity of hearing and chanting and remembering, is to surrender to the Lord. In the varnashram, we have many goals, including artha and kama, etc. And it was secondary goal, oh yes, we'll also progress upwards and can become sattvic, etc. Maybe we get liberation finally. But it is basically material. Whereas the devotional activities are completely, goal is non-material. Another difference is that the origin is different. The origin of bhakti is non-material. It does not arise from the gunas at all. It arises from the Supreme Lord. So bhakti is a shakti of the Lord, a spiritual shakti of the Lord. We know the Lord has his bahiranga shakti, material energy, which produces the material world and the gunas and the varnashram system. Sattva, Raja, Tamas, and the varnas, everything come out of the gunas, bahiranga shakti. And within that, sattva gun produces atmagyan, but it is also part of the gunas. It arises from sattva gun. Bhakti does not arise from that at all. It arises from a different energy, the antaranga shakti of the Lord. It's the internal energy of the Lord. From that we get bhakti. So the activities of bhakti may look material because we're using our eye and our hands and our feet and whatever, ear, voice. And it looks like we're doing material activities with our material body, but actually hearing, chanting, remembering, these are bhakti activities which are spiritual. They're part of Krishna's internal energy. So they arise from the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world, not from the material world in the Bahiranga Shakti. So completely different. If we're in the material world and we're bhaktas, we're devotees, and we're doing our hearing, chanting, and remembering, then the question was, well, how do I support my body? I got to eat. So then you have to go get a job, maybe. And as you're in the temple and they give you your food and your shelter. If you're outside, then you have to get a job. You can't just hear and chant all day. You need some food, you need a house, etc. So then you have to start doing some work. So the varnashram system was favorable for bhakti because you could fit into that system and do your activities outside, which are favorable. They had a little bhakti in them already, plus worship of devatas. And they're regulated to help you rise in the gunas. So you could do that along with your bhakti, and there's no problem for it. A very convenient system. The two can go together if you do have material needs. If we don't have the system, then there's a problem. We're doing our bhakti, and then what do we have to do? We have to go out in the material world where there's no svadharma, nothing is operating. We have to somehow struggle to get a job and support ourselves and associate with people in all sorts of different gunas. And the activities may not be regulated to raise us up in the gunas at all. They may keep us in the gunas, in the lower gunas, actually. So, not very favorable. So, that is problematic. However, Bhakti is very special. And in any circumstance, you can do bhakti and you can get success. And so that is why in Kali Yuga, the emphasis is upon doing the bhakti yoga. Because even if the conditions are very bad in Kali Yuga, with no varnashram system and a lot of tamagun ignorance and a lot of violence and social systems that don't know where they're going, still, bhakti can survive. You can do it in any position. The conditions may be unfavorable, but the devotee doesn't mind that. So in any condition, we can still perform the bhakti and we can still progress upwards through the bhakti process because it is beyond the gunas. Even obviously, bhakti in the material world is in the gunas. It comes into the gunas in any place, whether it's sattva, raja, tamas, and in any case, we can perform it. So whether it's in tamagun, rajagun, or sattvagun, we can perform the bhakti. And it has very great effect. So this is what Prabhupada points out in the purport, that whatever guna you're in, whatever varna you're in, even if you don't have a varna and you're a chandala or a mlecha or whatever, you can still do the bhakti and you can still get the success. It does not depend upon the gunas for success. It is independent. It's not caused by the gunas, and we can progress. However, we also know that certain things are more favorable for bhakti than others. And generally, sattvic environment, sattvic food, etc., are more favorable. Therefore, we have to choose within this material world those things more favorable and avoid those things less favorable. So, the other system is that along with the bhakti, if you do have the good fortune to have a varnashram system intact, then you would follow those rules of your particular varna along with your devotional activities. And they're favorable, so it's not so difficult. If we don't have anything at all, and it's all haphazard supporting your body by some method or other, then yes, more difficult. But the bhakti can still succeed. So, of course, in India, we have this system where we have the bhakti and we do have the varnashram system going along together. So, we have to make that system favorable, the varnashram system favorable. So here it says it should be animittena. That nimitta means with a cause. So, and animittena means causeless, which means we're not interested in getting the material goals out of our Swadharma, because obviously the Swadharma is there to get material benefits, to get punyas, to rise up in the gunas, to go to Svargaloka, etc. Worship the deva doesn't get material benefits, etc. So, we can do those things for along with the bhakti, but then we should start discarding all these material benefits and just do them as duty without looking for material enjoyment. So if the dharma is there and we're born into that system, then we perform those activities according to the specific varna, and we do it without material desires, without desires for material benefit. We do them simply as long as we're there in order that we support our material body. Finished. And we continue to do the devotional activities, which are here called Kriya Yoga. So, and this way we can do the activities if the system is there. And that we see is how the devotees in the past did their activities. So Lord Chaitanya was born into that system, his followers were born in that system, and they followed the rules of their particular varna. If they were a Vaishya or a Sudra, a Kshatriya, a Brahmana, they followed those rules. At the same time, they did their bhakti. As Kali Yuga progresses, even in India, and what to speak of other places in the world, system is not there. Not much intact. So in modern India, not much remnants of that system at all. And other places, there's nothing there. That doesn't mean that bhakti stops. No, bhakti continues in any case. And it's only the bhakti that is going to give some good result in Kali Yuga. The other things cannot really do so much because they're fragmented and not perfect. So we continue the bhakti in any case, and like that. And in any case, whether we're doing the varnashram system and the bhakti or just the bhakti or whatever, the emphasis is always on the devotional activities, because these are the activities beyond the gunas coming from the Supreme Lord, and these are what give the result. At the most, by doing the activities in the varnashram system, the goal becomes moksha, ultimately, artha, dharma, kama, and moksha. That we do atma-jnana and sattva-good, and we get liberation. It doesn't include prema there at all. Where's the bhakti and prema? Not there. So then the real goal should be to get prema through bhakti. So that we emphasize that more than anything else. However, as I said, because we do have associate in the material world, some people are working in the material world, still they have to follow some principles. They can't just do any job, which is the most sinful work, and expect to survive in bhakti also. We have to be very careful how we act in this material world and do activities which are favorable, even if we're working or whatever. So we choose a job which is non-violent as much as possible. We choose a job that doesn't interfere with others. It does not interfere with other living entities and cause unnecessary destruction, etc. So we have some responsibility in our job, even if we're doing some activity in Kali Yuga beyond the Varnashram system. And of course, along with that, we do the bhakti itself. So we can choose also to regulate ourselves, because we have a material body, according to the rules of Varnashram, even if we cannot follow the full Varnashram. So that is what we do. We take elements of the Varnashram system, like rules for cleanliness, etc. And we follow those rules. They're not difficult to follow, because we do have a material body. So we follow those rules of cleanliness, etc. We may not follow those perfectly either. Because if we look at the rules in the Varnashram system, the rules especially for the Brahmana are very complex. How to bathe is governed by rules. Now, you don't just jump into the water, jump into the shower, and that's it. No. There's certain rules on how you do that activity with mantras and prayers, etc., whatever. How you wash your body, etc., how you dry your body, etc., is controlled by rules. And if you pass water, you have to pass in a certain direction. But you can't do that because in the modern world, like that. If you have a toothbrush, your toothbrush is a twig, and the twig is certain fingers long according to the Veda that you follow. You have to measure your toothbrush before you start brushing your teeth. So there's all sorts of complicated rules there which no one can follow in the modern world. Very difficult. No, some basic principles we can follow. Basic rules of cleanliness and dress and things like that. We can follow something. So we follow those rules. And more important than that, of course, is even association. We follow rules of association. In the Varnashram rule system, generally people restricted of the Varnas, so you didn't associate with the lower guna people. The Brahmins would not associate with the Sudras closely. They would stay distant from them, not talk to them. So there were rules of association there. We can't avoid in Kali Yuga, there's no restrictions at all in place, so we can't avoid that thing. But what we can do is to choose good association by our choice and associate with those persons more. We have satsanga, so to speak. And this is favorable for us. So certain elements of the Varnashram system we can use in our individual practice, which are favorable. Rules for cleanliness, rules for social interaction, etc. Physically, mentally, socially, we can use those rules as long as they're not unfavorable for the devotional development. So in that sense, we can do dharma to some degree. Very difficult to follow perfectly in this Kali Yuga. We do what we can. So both are praised here. The svadharma is mahiyasa, which means very great, it's glorious or whatever, to follow those activities properly. But without material desires, without motive of anything material. So the ultimate thing is to get advancement and ultimately go to Svarga Loka, etc. That's the the glory of following your Svadharma. You get to Sattva-guna and you go to Svargaloka, but that is considered to be useless for the devotee. So we don't follow for that reason. We follow the Dharma only in its favorability to bhakti and using our body, etc. For that reason, okay, we do it. So, favorable to bhakti means those things which are help us in hearing, chanting, remembering, etc. Those things are favorable. So in other words, those things which are favorable to keep our mind in a very clean, pure condition, alert condition, so that we can do the devotional activities for Krishna. Those things are the favorable activities of the Varna system. If a person is not doing bhakti at all, and is only doing the Varna ashram system, in one sense, it's useless. Or we can say maybe it's a little bit good because there is an element of devotion within the system itself. So it's a little bit of bhakti within this whole system where the ultimate goal maybe is moksha or artha or kama, etc. So not so good, but at least it's headed in the right direction and there is a little bhakti there so that you can progress through the gunas. So in that sense, it's a step towards bhakti. But if we separate it completely and there's no goal of bhakti at all, ultimately, then it becomes useless. So for that reason, often we see a condemnation of the Varnashram system. In Lord Chaitanya Charitamrita, we see that Lord Chaitanya often condemns the whole system. Useless, useless, useless. In his talks to Ramananda Roy, and in talks to the Madhva, the followers of Madhva, then he said, it's useless. Like that. So if it is, the goal is not to come to bhakti at all, then it becomes useless. If people don't have any bhakti, fine, let them do the system and gradually progress and become purified. And then by association, eventually, they can take to the process of bhakti. Then it becomes slightly useful. But still, the idea is that they're quite different systems. We can't equate Varnashram exactly with bhakti. Bhakti is spiritual activity coming from the Supreme Lord. Varnashram is in the material world, arising from the gunas. So they're quite different in their very nature. The best we can do is spiritualize those activities by adding Krishna in them somewhere else. And if we're a devotee, then we use them. We're using our body for Krishna more or less. So therefore, the ultimate result of our following our Svadharma is that we can make it favorable for doing devotional activities. So that is, we could say, the benefit of the system itself. So ultimately, the main emphasis for us is on those activities of devotion, which are by their nature are spiritual activities. They're imbued with the Shakti of the Supreme Lord, His spiritual Shakti, and very, very powerful. So even if we have fault in our Dharma, the very nature of the activities of bhakti are such that they make up for all the faults that we may have. And, of course, at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna say? Give up all dharmas and simply surrender unto me, and I will protect you from all sinful activities. I deliver you from all sinful activities. So, one may think that if I reject my Svadharma, then that becomes sinful. But then Krishna says, no, by doing the surrender to Krishna, all those sins, even those sins, are dissipated. However, we cannot then say, okay, I'm a devotee, then I can do all sinful activities and no problem. Here it says, not excessively himsa, not excessively sinful. So if we do intentional sins, that is not good at all. It is also opposite of bhakti. It's unfavorable for bhakti. So we have within the rules of bhakti, that system is there. So if you look in the 64 angas of bhakti, you'll find one of the rules is don't disturb other living entities. That's one of the primary rules, the first 20. The door to bhakti. Don't disturb other living entities. That's one of the rules. So, we cannot have excessive violence. But as Prabhupada mentions, yes, in order to live, we do have to kill some plants or whatever. So according to scripture, there's things permitted and there's things that are not permitted. So we have to follow those rules. Yeah. Otherwise, it becomes unfavorable for bhakti. Yeah. So we follow the bhakti principally, and along with that, then we have to be very careful to minimize the violence that we commit in this material world in the process of bhakti itself. And if we're not following a varnashram system, we have to keep that in mind anyway, that we avoid the sinful activities, we avoid the violence, etc., disturbing other living entities as much as possible. So in this way, if we can follow even that one simple principle, simply avoiding all the violence, then when we're doing our bhakti, then we can make that process very successful. So that the violence also is related to the four regulator principles. So as mentioned, those are sinful activities. And we find in the first canto of Bhagavatam, in the story of Parikshit and his discussions and his looking at the personification of Kali, etc., and Kali attacking the bull, etc., then we understand that there are some very sinful activities there. And that is encoded in the four regulative principles. You don't do those things that, since we're protecting Dharma by doing those activities and saving the bull. So that becomes favorable by following regulative principles. This avoids the violence and the sin, so that we're not ati himsrena. We don't follow the principle of excessive violence, etc. So therefore, along with our devotional activities, we follow these regulative principles as a simple basis to avoid the violence in the material world. So ultimately, the system is very simple. We do very simple process of bhakti, and we follow regulative principles, and we can succeed in that way, even if we cannot follow all the other rules. If we can follow the other rules, fine. And then the Svadharma rules, etc., very good. If somehow we don't know about them or we can't follow them perfectly, still follow the principles of bhakti and without the excessive violence, and we can progress very nicely. This is because, why? This is most pleasing to Krishna. Following the bhakti is more pleasing than anything else. Okay, any question? Well, it could be justified in one sense, just as in the war, the Arjuna has to kill people, not just animals. He has to kill people because it was the order of Krishna, and it was the kshatriya, the duty of the kshatriya, that he has to defend the state or whatever from other persons, so he may have to kill persons and whatever. We could give the same argument in terms of medical science, that they would have to kill in order to save human beings, we have to experiment on animals or something. But at least if they're going to do it, they have to do it in the most humane way also, not in the worst ways or whatever they do it in, using excessive violence. If they can avoid it completely, fine, that's even better. So we do find nonviolent medicines. They say, well, medicine was made without experimenting on the animals by doing awful things to them, whatever, and causing them excessive pain or whatever. Yeah. So there probably are methods by which we could avoid all that. And maybe we have to, in a certain case, do some minimum things with animals or whatever. Try to avoid as much as possible. Of course, the other thing is that we just use traditional medicines, like Ayurveda. They don't have to experiment on animals to use those at all. Oh, they get disturbed. We're disturbed by your kirtan. Well, the general rule is there. And even the rule is, you don't preach to the faithless persons and don't disturb a person. But if you're a jnani, you don't disturb the person who's doing his dharma and say, give up your dharmas and just practice jnana and renounce everything so you don't disturb the person. There's general rules like that. But then the other rule is that the exception is the bhakti. You can disturb a person by telling him, give this up and do bhakti, as Krishna does at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, it's better if they have faith, but then we have to produce the faith also, then we can tell them something like that. Still, we also have to tell the truth. So for the people in the material world, we can't preach to the faithless persons, but what we can do, we can let them hear the kirtan, whether they like it or not, and that's not considered bad. So they don't like it, but it pierces the ear and it goes in and affects the atma. So it's beneficial for them. So sometimes they may not like it, but we give them the medicine anyway, and it helps cure them a little bit, even if it's a little bit within. So the way we preach to the non-devotees, the persons who are inimical, is let them hear the kirtan at least. So that is considered to be okay. That's permissible. Unless they die as a result of the kirtan or something due to some peculiar problem of hearing or something, I don't know, but that's probably unlikely. So it's not going to affect them in a very, physically in a very painful way at all. It's just their psychology more or less. But even that's good for them. As we see in the case of Krishna with the demons, they didn't like Krishna, like Sishupala, and he couldn't tolerate looking at him, he couldn't tolerate hearing his name, but he chanted his name anyway, and it was beneficial for him. He got purified by that anyway. So when he got killed, he went to Vaikuntha. Raghunuga. Well, that's explained in the Nectar of Devotion there, Rupa Goswami. They're both sadhana. They're both practices. Without any ruchi doing it. Well, of course we can have with ruchi or without ruchi, whatever, but anyway, they're both sadhana. And in terms of process, that means we're engaging the senses to attain bhava and then prema. So we don't have bhava, haven't seen Krishna in either case, whereas Vaidhi or Raghunuga. The difference is that Raghunuga is especially meant for Krishna, not for other forms of the Lord, because the very definition is to follow after the Brajavasis in Vrindavan, not in Dvaraka or Mathura even, and develop a similar spontaneous type of love where we don't see Krishna as God. So there's an emphasis on Krishna in Vrindavan and with the very familiar mood without the reverence. And so there's great spontaneity, like Mother Yasoda does not see Krishna as God. She sees him as her son only, and she treats him like the son. If she sees him as God, then she will not treat him like the son anymore. So it's a process to encourage that very spontaneous service to the Lord, seeing Krishna not as Supreme Lord. And therefore there's an emphasis upon hearing the Bhagavatam 10th canto, the chapters on Krishna and his Vrindavan pastimes, and choosing a particular person in there as an ideal to follow after. That's why it's called Raghunuga. Raga means that spontaneous love, and Anuga means to follow after them. So we're following after a particular Brajabhasi with a particular rasa and trying to develop a similar type of mood and rasa, ultimately. So we can say it's more particular than the Vaidhi Bhakti in that sense, which depends on rules and regulations and seeing Krishna with awe and reverence, etc. So we do a lot of hearing and chanting, etc., related to our particular chosen relationship with Krishna. And that's the essence of the Raghunuga. Along with that, you can also have your particular spiritual form, which hasn't developed yet, but you concentrate on a certain form, and in meditation you serve the Lord in that form, which could be a gopi, a manjari, a cowherd boy, or an elder gopa or a gopi, and then you try to serve Krishna in meditation in that particular form. No, the definition doesn't depend on ruchi or not ruchi, except it depends upon a particular greed, it says, a greed. If we don't have the greed, I suppose if you want to call that the aruchi stage, then you could, but then you wouldn't want to do it anyway. probably. So you should have some desire to do it. So the qualification is the greed, which may develop before ruchi stage. In other words, just by association with devotees, then you may develop this idea that, yes, my goal is to attain a position in Vrindavan, in the spiritual world, and I should cultivate a relationship in that way. It may develop at the very beginning of bhakti, because in previous lifetimes you also had a devotional development already. So it could develop at any stage, not particularly the ruchi stage. Oh, well, the idea is that, you know, we, to simply desire to go to the plan of the Lord or to have a form in the spiritual world without the service, that's kind of ridiculous. Because you can get it in one sense if you do mixed bhakti. The Lord eventually takes you to the spiritual world where you get a nice form, but you don't really serve the Lord directly. You're not unfavorable to the Lord, obviously. You're favorable to the Lord, but you don't serve Him directly. You meditate on the Lord. So there's that type of person. So, but then, of course, the real devotee is practicing pure bhakti. His desire is to simply serve the Lord in his particular relationship. Whether he gets the spiritual body or the spiritual planet is incidental. That's not his concern. But the Lord gives them anyway. Okay? So for one practicing pure bhakti, salokya, sarsti, samipya, etc. are incidental. The main thing is simply to please the Lord. And the Lord supplies whatever. But he generally gives these things to the devotee. Huh? So it's mainly a matter of emphasis of what we put on these things. Huh? Obviously, if you go to the spiritual world, then you get a spiritual body, etc. But the emphasis is not on going to the spiritual world. The emphasis is upon the service to the Lord, the pure service to the Lord. That's our emphasis. So the system as it evolved over the ages was like that. So even when the British came, we'll find they're describing in their books how the Brahmin would walk down the street and everybody had to hide. They couldn't show their faces. The common people could not show their faces when a Brahmin walked down the street even. That was when the British came, you know, a few hundred years ago. So, you know. Of course, how do we interact at all? How we have a social system, whatever. Maybe that's as it evolved like that was maybe a distortion of the system or whatever. It's Kali Yuga entered in or whatever. And we see that obviously the Brahmins employed sudras also. So they were completely aloof from them. They had their own servants who were sudras or whatever, and they employed them or kept them in their house or whatever. So. Maybe we could say this is a distortion of the system, but nevertheless, there was an idea of, avoiding the lower association as much as possible, because Sangha is obviously influential on a person. Huh? And we also have that in devotional service. We have satsangha and we avoid the asatsangha. So we can say that's discrimination. You're not associating with those people and these people. But it's a choice we have to make for our devotional development. In terms of how to apply that Varnashram system now, obviously it's very difficult to do that system in the particular way it was done 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It's very unlikely that it could be acceptable by the society because of the rules that are there. No one will accept them nowadays. We have a democracy. Even that is not Varnashramic, so you know the whole system is completely different. So we can only apply certain aspects of a Varnashram system in the modern world. Some things we cannot do.
Am I talking about the Varnashram system? Mm-hmm. You talk about the Varna, which is glorified Dharma, Artha, and Kama, and then Moksha, Vaipa, and Buddha. What about the Ashram? Is it rather than divided by Bhakti and Dharma, or is it also Kama?
It's also somewhat by the varnas. So the sudras only have a grihastha ashram. They don't have a brahmacharya ashram. They don't have a vanaprastha or a sannyasa ashram. Not at all. Huh? The upper varnas, the vaishyas, kshatriyas, and brahmanas, the kshatriyas and the vaishyas, they can go brahmachari, grihastha, and then vanaprastha. And the brahmana, all four. He can do all four. So there's some distinction there in the ashramas also. If you see the Vaishya or the Kshatriya, they become a brahmachari, and then they become a grihastha, and maybe a vanaprastha. And that's as far as they go. So there is an encouragement in vanaprastha to become a little detached. So whether it becomes devotional or not, that's another thing. It may just be towards renunciation or whatever. And if you become a brahmana, then it's detachment, sannyas, which may not be Vaishnavic, maybe impersonal. Become a sannyasi and follower of Shankaracharya or something, you know. So it's not specifically, you know, Vaishnavic, and it could go in the other direction towards impersonalism as well. So we could say it generally goes towards renunciation and spiritual and understanding you're not the body in general. That's the direction it goes in. You can do them, but as I said, you have to give up the material desires, as it says here, anumitena. The Swadharma should be anumitena. So we have the example of Arjuna. He wasn't doing it for himself as a kshatriya to go to Svargaloka or whatever, which is glorified for a kshatriya to die in the battlefield bravely. You go to Svargaloka, or anybody in the system, if they follow their dharma, they get reward for that, material reward. But if we're following bhakti also, then we give up those desires. We do it out of duty only to set an example for others. But we don't look after the trying to get, you know, material promotion, going to Svargaloka, etc. We just do it for example for others. That's all we do it for. So that's what we've given up all the causes, you know, the material benefits or whatever. And we concentrate on the bhakti aspect to please Krishna. What is that?
Mode of
goodness. Yeah.
It's not a prerequisite for pure devotion.
It's not?
It's not a prerequisite for pure devotion.
No. Like the Chandala, he chants the holy name once purely, then he's more qualified than a brahmana. The example is given in Nectar Devotion, yeah? And for, quoting from Bhagavatam. Oh, that's an imperfect type of bhakti. We can do two things with the bhakti. We can mix it with the activities of Varnashram, the angas of Varnashram, like you do your sandhya vandanas and whatever like that, or you do the pancha mahayagyas and you worship the devatas, and you kind of do that along with the bhakti. So that's one type of mixing of elements of two things. The other is to mix motives. So we can do bhakti with tamasic motives, not particularly varnashram or sudra duties or anything like that, but with just do bhakti without any varnashram, but we have tamasic motives or rajasic motives or sattvic motives. Then it becomes rajasic bhakti, tamasic bhakti, or sattvic bhakti. So the tamasic is the motives would be violence towards other creatures and you know, for our benefit. And in Rajasic, it is, again, beneficial sense gratification for myself is the goal. So we do the bhakti with ideas of getting enjoyment, material enjoyment. Then it becomes Rajasic bhakti. And Sattvic bhakti, ultimately, we do the bhakti with some goal of liberation, moksha. So they're all mixed with other motives. So then we define them according to the gunas like that. So we have karma, Mr. Bhakti. We can mix the elements of karma yoga with the varnashram, with the bhakti. And if there's no element of sattva, rajas, tamas at all, then okay, we do it. Simply to set an example for others, as Arjuna does. So he's not doing rajasic bhakti by following kshatriya rules, because he has no material motive at all. But we can say once it's karma, Mr. Bhakti, but it's permissible because it's animitena. No material goals at all. Yeah, still pure. Yeah. In one sense. We usually were karma, Mr. Bhakti, we all have the desires also, but without that, it's okay. Yeah? So that's what is said here. You can do the Svadharma as long as it's animitena, without the material goals in mind. Then you do it. Why would we do it? To set an example for others, and certain elements are favorable for our body, etc. We need an occupation if we're working and we have a family, so we have to support. We do them to support our family, whatever. But they don't interfere with the bhakti. So that type of karma, Mr. Bhakti, is okay. When we start putting the other things into it, then it's no good. Material desires. But even if we don't do the karma, Mr. Bhakti, with the elements of karma yoga, but we do have the desires, it's also bad. Either way. From the very beginning of bhakti, we have that definition of, you know, anyabhilashita shunya. At the same time, we do have anartas. And we're going through the process of anartha navritti, nishta, ruchi, asakti, and all through there is anartas, but they're getting less and less and less. So in one sense, it's not pure bhakti in the absolute sense, only pure bhakti would be prema. But we call the whole process pure bhakti because we have to have a process to get to that highest level. So we call the whole process pure bhakti, as long as we're adhering to this principle that, let's say, explicitly we're not desiring these goals. In other words, when we're hearing and chanting, we're not thinking of how to get my material benefits out of this, you know, directly. We may have in our subconscious these things that are still there, fine. But at least consciously we're not praying for these particular things. That's how we call the pure bhakti and sadhana. It's called Uttama Bhakti or pure bhakti at that stage. But through that, the anartas begin to decrease and decrease and decrease. Anartha navritti takes place. And simultaneously, the attraction to Krishna increases. So when we get to ruchi, then the attraction is visibly more for Krishna and much less for material things. If we get to asakti, it's even more prominent, our attraction for Krishna and our less attraction for Maya. So it's an automatic process if we follow the pure bhakti in sadhana from the very beginning that eventually we do get to ruchi and asakti and then we get to bhava and prema. And the other desires keep decreasing more and more until they're zero. Well, it depends on their consciousness, how they're doing their bhakti. And they don't have to be a grihastha, they could be a sannyasi and do mixed bhakti as well. Sannyasa is part of the karma yoga system also in one sense, so therefore they're also participating, doing an anga of karma yoga. So theoretically they shouldn't have any desires, but they may have desires also. And a grihastha could have desires or not have material desires as far as his performance of bhakti is concerned. And so we see that in Lord Chaitanya's movement, many of his followers were grihasthas. Most of them were grihasthas, not sannyasis. 99% were grihasthas, his followers. But that doesn't make them not practicing pure bhakti. So it's more the attitude of the mind than the external situation of ashram or varna, which is important for developing bhakti. And we see Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a grihastha most of his life. That did not impede his bhakti at all. Okay. Hare Krishna.